given the first time, but I think a most precise title of what I'm going to talk about would be something like this one. So a model independent implications of the plus and minus phi bar cosmic ray spectrum dark matter properties and the constraints from gamma rays and radio waves. Long title that cannot fit in the program, but this is what I'm going to do. So I'm going to do something which is model independent on the possible interpretations of the data that we've seen presented in the previous three talks and also others about cosmic ray, gamma rays and radio waves. Okay, so this is work done in collaboration with these yellow people here, in particular Alessandro, who now has gone for a second, but will be back in a moment. And we're going to give basically two back-to-back talks. So I'm going to give the first part, where I concentrate on life before Fermi, okay, as if the last talk didn't happen and nobody presented the data on plus plus and minus. And instead, he is going to give the modifications of the pictures about after Fermi and also other further developments. Okay, so this is a dark matter conference, so I don't have to convince you about the evidence for dark matter, and will not do that. I will have just 2 minutes of introduction, just to say that from galaxy rotation curves, from clusters, from galaxy lensing, from gravitational lensing in clusters of galaxies, but above all from cosmological fits, such as those of a cosmic microwave background, the large scale structure, dark matter we know exists. And otherwise, it would not be here in the sense that the structure would not have formed and so on. So it consists of a particle because its density scales as one of the volume as the universe expands. And we are pretty convinced that it permeates galactic halos and so on. So the question is not what is dark matter nowadays, if dark matter exists or not at this point, at least for people that are sitting here. But the question is, what is the dark matter? Okay. So theorists have the prejudice or the bias that dark matter could easily be something which is a thermal relic from the early universe. Okay, so a particle that was as abundant as everything else in the early universe, and then through annihilation that at some point stopped, froze out, remained as an abundant component of the universe still nowadays. And the prejudice is also that this particle could be a WIMP, that is a particle with a weak mass of the order of the TeV, or hundreds of GeV to TeV, typical of weak interactions, and indeed with weak standard model interactions, because in that case, the abundance that I get solving the Boltzmann equation in the early, from the early universe is the one that we observe today, that is 0.23 or something like that. Okay? So the theoretical prejudice is a particle with a mass of 1 TeV and the cross section, which is the thermal one, this one that you probably know very well, 3 × 10⁻²⁶ centimeter cube per second. That gives me the total relic abundance in the correct amount. Okay, so we'll see that actually something very different is needed in order to fit the data that we have seen this morning and that we are seeing since 11 months. Okay, so we want to detect dark matter, and as you know, we have three main avenues, direct detection, we'll hear about that tomorrow, this afternoon and tomorrow and so on. We can try to produce colliders, if one will ever work, or we can try to focus on indirect detection, that means looking for the secondary products of annihilations of dark matter particles in the galactic halo. Okay, and this is what we are concerned in these days. So I'm going to focus first on the antimatter charged particles, that is positrons and antiprotons, because this is the hot topic at the moment, Pamela, Attic, Fermi, and so on, okay? So let me remind you about the basic picture of what indirect detection means. And I will just show cartoons, because we have the expert here that will talk later. Indirect detection means that we have to follow the propagation of secondary products from dark matter annihilations, such as antiprotons, positrons, and so on, through their journey through the galaxy while, and collect them at Earth. So this is the picture. Here is our galaxy. We are sitting 8.5 kiloparsec away from the center or something like that. And as we know, the galaxy is immersed in a halo of dark matter particles that now appeared. And every now and then, two dark matter particles find each other, annihilate, and produce fluxes of electron, positron, proton, antiproton, and so on. So I will be concerned with the production part later, of course, but this is what happens any time in the galaxy. So we focus on the antimatter because the background for that is much less than for the matter part. Now, Once the fluxes of particles, of antiparticles, have been produced, they go through a lot of things before they can get to us. And so, for instance, they are entangled in the galactic magnetic field, and so they lose energy by synchrotron radiation and so on. They are blown away by the wind of galactic cosmic rays from the stars that sit in the galactic disk that tend to blow them away. So, for instance, this part, this energy loss is more important for positrons than for antiprotons, and instead the cosmic wind is more important for heavy particles such as protons and not for electrons. But anyway, all of this happens during the journey. They can suffer spallation on the interstellar medium, so that is the galactic gas that is permeating the galaxy. And so some of the flux under the particle could be removed or lose some energy and be rejected at the lower energy in the flux and so on. And after all this, they come to us and they are collected by experiments such as Pamela, Fermi, and so on. Okay? So all of this part is taken into account by in several possible ways, either numerically or semi-analytically, which is what we did also, thanks to these methods that have been developed by Pierre and the other French and Italian groups during the past 15 or 20 years or so. So you write down I'm just showing the basic things that will be probably discussed more later. You write down an energy, a diffusion loss equation that contains a term for each one of the things that I described above, that is diffusion, energy loss, convective winds, spallations, and it contains a source term due to dark matter annihilations, and you solve it in a box that encapsulates the galaxy and that has a given size L, which is this one here, which is a free parameter, and so on. So in a semi-analytic way, you can get how the spectrum evolves from production to detection. Okay, so all of this is a complicated process, but for my purposes, the important thing to notice is that there are many free parameters inside here, such as the diffusion coefficient, the energy loss coefficients, the velocity wind, the velocity of the wind, the size of the box, and so on. And these are basically the theoretical uncertainty, systematical uncertainties that is intrinsic in the propagation part from production to detection. Okay, so when I want to make fits and to give predictions for what the dark matter signal would look like at detection, what I will have done later is always to scan over the possible choices for these parameters and present the best fit. Okay, so I will show later some fits, and this is what I will have done concerning the propagation part. Now, apart from the details, what sets the overall expected flux of cosmic antimatter that we expect to collect on Earth? Well, of course, that flux is proportional to the square of n, where n is the density of dark matter particles in any given point of the galaxy, and it's squared because two dark matter particles have to find each other and annihilate. And it depends on the annihilation cross-section, of course, okay? So the first part is determined by astrophysics and cosmology, and the second part is instead particle physics. And not this, the only thing I want to say is that the reference number that we have in mind is something 10 to the minus 26, because that's the natural choice for thermal Rayleigh abundance. About the astrophysics and cosmology, something that you know very well, let's talk 1 second about how dark matter is distributed in the galaxy. Well, of course, we don't know anything precise, but we have computers, we can do simulations, and try to infer the profile of the density of dark matter as a function of the galactic, of the radius from the center of the galaxy down to ourselves and the periphery of the galaxy, okay? So different groups during the last 30 years or so did this job, and they came up with a different fitting formula that are represented here, or here, the most recent ones from last year. So you have the well-known core isothermal profile, which is something like, which is this line here that has this flat in the center, and more steep profiles such as Navarro-Frankel-White, which is this one, or the Mu profile, which is probably now quite disfavored. And more recently, something that is in between, say, a core and the spike profile, that is the Einasto profile, that goes with an exponential at the small radii, okay? So from my point of view, again, this is systematic uncertainty, okay? Theory cannot predict this, and so I will always scan over the possible choices of dark matter profiles that are listed here and present results for the best possibility of these, or for a a range, an array of possibilities. Okay. On top of the smooth profile, there could be little clumps, inhomogeneities. Actually, dark matter simulations tell us that there are little inhomogeneities, clumps, overdensities that are present in the galactic halo. And these are important for indirect detection, as you know, because they can boost the annihilation rate. That is, they can give an annihilation a boost factor. Because since the dark matter annihilation rate depends on the density squared, if there is an overdensity, then the annihilation rate is boosted by its presence. So typical boost factors go from 1 to 20 or something like that, okay? Not much more, just to remind you of the basic numbers. Okay, so that's enough for the introduction. Let's go and compute what theory predicts in terms of the signals of dark matter annihilations. As I said, I will do that in a completely model-independent way, and that means that I will take two dark matter particles, okay, and I assume that they annihilate in some way that I don't want to know into some primary channels, that is W plus W minus, ZZ bar, BB bar, tau plus tau minus, quark anti-quark, and so on. Okay, I consider all the possible primary channels. So any given model, supersymmetry, Kaluza Klein, will have something in this blob, but we are not considering that. Then these primary products, such as W plus B minus, tau plus tau minus, and so on, have to decay, hadronize, and make parton showers, and whatever they have to do. And this, we follow this process with the Pythia 8, Pythia 4, Pythia 6, a combination of those, a standard Monte Carlo tools. And finally, you get to the spectra of final stable standard model products, such as positrons, antiprotons, maybe also antideuterium, gammas, neutrinos, and so on. So here are some examples of the spectra that we get. I've taken a mass of dark matter of 1 TeV, and indeed you see that that's the endpoint of the spectrum, of course. And for different primary channels, I'm plotting the positron fraction and the antiproton fraction. And as you see, different primary channels have different spectrum, of course. So if you go directly into E plus E minus, you have a very peaked spectrum, which is this red, with this green line here. If instead you go into W plus W minus, you have a smoother spectrum because you have to go through hadronization, parton shower, and so on before you produce positrons. For antiprotons, the spectra are still different, but still more or less, but more one like the other, because you always have to go through decay, parton shower, and so on in order to get to the hadrons, the antiprotons. Okay, very trivial stuff. So what are the particle physics parameters that we are considering and scanning over? The dark matter mass and all the possible primary channels that are listed there. Okay. So I go and compare with the data that we have seen also this morning and many other times. First set of data are the positrons from Pamela, and I'm not going to repeat anything about that. And here are the data that we also saw this morning. So two basic features. Here I'm plotting the positron fraction as Pier Giorgio did as a function of the energy. Here I'm plotting the Pamela data points, the red dots, over some assumed background that has a lot of uncertainties, and that's why there is a question mark there, and we will hear about that more later. But this is, the Moskalenko-Strong conventional background from 99 that was shown also this morning. So two basic features, as we heard, a steep rise from 10 GeV up, and a very large flux compared to the background, okay, as we know. So Pamela is the real breakthrough here, in the sense that whatever it is, it has discovered something that we really didn't expect, right? Something that is much above the background, unless you make some assumptions on the background, that is, that we'll hear about that later. Anyway, either Pamela has discovered dark matter or a nearby pulsar or a completely wrong computation of the background or a completely wrong computation of standard cosmic rays and so on, but something has been discovered here, I think, okay? Next set of data are the antiprotons from Pamela, and as we heard this morning, this completely, actually here I'm not showing the ratio, I'm showing the flux of antiprotons, but anyway, the important message is that they follow precisely the background and no excess is seen. Okay, so this will be a constraint on any dark matter model because you have to produce positrons and not antiprotons. Okay, so the question is now, which dark matter spectra can fit this data that we have seen? So I'll make some examples, and then I'll give you the complete analysis with all the channels and all the masses. First example, let's take a dark matter with a mass of 150 GeV, that annihilates in W plus W minus. That would be, for instance, a supersymmetric queen or something like that. Does it fit the positron fraction from Pappe? Well, yes, very well. As you see, I sum to the background the signal from this dark matter annihilation, given the spectra that I gave before, and what you get is something that goes through the points very well. Okay? Now, while doing this, what I've done is scanning all the possible propagation parameters, scanning all the possible dark matter density profiles, and adapting the background within the uncertainties in order to find the best fit. Okay? And we can discuss about that if you want. But does this same candidate fit the antiproton data? No, of course it doesn't. Because if you produce that W plus W minus in the first place, then they also produce quarks, and those produce antiprotons. And so you would see an excess. You should have seen an excess that Pamela hasn't seen. Okay? So this kind of candidate is excluded if this is the mechanism of dark matter annihilation that you consider. Okay. Now let's make another example. Let's take a dark matter with a mass of 10 TeV that annihilates again into W plus W minus. Does it fit the positrons and antiprotons from Pamela? Yes, it does. And as you see, the way it fits is that at low energies, the tail of the spectrum is fitting the data here. At high energies, for positrons, low energies are fitting the spectrum. For antiprotons, what happens is that the excess should show up at energies that are larger than those that have been probed by Pamela so far. Okay? So if you go at a large mass such as 10 TeV, then you're safe. By a little room here. Now, with the new data point that was presented this morning somewhere here, maybe then also the mass has to be pushed even larger, to even larger, in order to fit in this way. Okay, but the important number that I haven't given to you so far is what is the annihilation cross-section that I need in order to fit this data? Well, as you know, that's a huge number, and in this case is 6 × 10⁻²² centimeter cube per second. That is a boost over the thermal cross-section of 20,000. Okay, so this is uncomfortable in some sense. You need a huge annihilation cross-section in order to get the huge flux of positrons that you see here. Now, there are models that can give you such a large annihilation cross-section in a sort of natural way. For instance, this model called Minimal Dark Matter by Strumia and collaborators. And it features a mass of 9.7 TeV, of a particle of a mass of 9.7 TeV that annihilates into W plus and W minus. And it features also something which is called Sommerfeld enhancement, of which we'll talk, we'll hear more this afternoon, I think. That is a particle physics mechanism that boosts and enhances the annihilation cross-section. And so with that and just an astrophysical boost of order 30, you can fit both the positrons and the antiproton data. Okay? Talking about Pamela here. Anyway, these were examples. Let's look at the complete picture. So here is the complete picture of fitting Pamela positrons only for the moment. So as a function of the mass, we are plotting, of the mass of the dark matter, we are plotting the chi-squared of the fit, okay? And so as you see, for the different primary channels that are listed here, as you see, everything goes, basically. So the 150 GV we know that goes into the large W minus has a local squared. The 10 TV particle that goes into a W plus W minus has a local squared. So everything can fit, basically. But as soon as you add antiprotons, what happens is that only the leptonic primary channels are left here, covering over the range of masses from 100 GV up to whatever you want. And instead, the primary channels from gauge bosons and from quarks are confined at the large mass part of the plane because of the reason I said before, because of the constraints from antiprotons, basically. So in other words, fitting Pamela positrons plus protons gives you two possibilities for dark matter. It must either be a particle that annihilates only into leptons, for instance, the plus and minus, and then the mass can be whatever it is, whatever you want. Or it must be a particle with a very large mass, about 10 TeV or more, and then it can fit, it can annihilate also in the plus and minus and quarks and so on. The cross-section which is required to fit is in any case very large, and with respect to the reference thermal cross section, is 3 or 4 orders of magnitude large. So, for instance, the 10 TeV particle going into W plus W minus requires something like 6 × 10²², which is the number I said before. Okay. Now, Pamela is not the end of the story, and the story continued the last year with the data from the APIC that we heard about and PPP-backed balloon experiments and so on. So these are bigger and denser instruments, so they can go to higher energies, but they cannot discriminate the charge. And so they present the results on the sum of electrons plus positrons. Here are the results that we saw. And what we have seen here is, we are supposed to see here is a peak at about 700 GeV, about which we talked this morning. So what's the, let's take this seriously, because I'm talking before Fermi always, okay? Let's take this seriously. What was the implication, what is the implication of this for dark matter? Let's make another example. Let's take a dark matter with a mass of 1 TeV that annihilates into mu plus mu minus, so leptons. Does it fit all the data sets that we have discussed so far? Yes, it fits. So it fits positrons, doesn't produce any antiproton because it's a leptonic channel, and it perfectly fits the attic excess here. Okay? So that's why people got so excited from October last year on. Have we identified dark matter for the first time? Is it a particle that has these generic properties of a mass about 1 TeV and annihilation into leptonic channels mainly? And that's why all the old loads models were proposed, of course, no? So the model-independent results confirm this hint from the example that I give. Simply, as you see, when you add the balloon experiments, all the chi-squared curves are lifted, except for the leptonic ones, that now point to a mass of 1 or about 2 TeV or so. And so only one possibility is left, and it is this one with a mass of about 1 TeV. Later, Fermi presented data and Hess presented data, but I'm not going to talk about this. And instead, this will be covered by Alessandro in the next talk. Now, two important remarks. First, the first one is that maybe all of this is just astrophysics, okay? Maybe it's just a pulsar and some other astrophysics that we don't know about. But I will not talk about that. The other important remark is that, I mean, because I'm not an expert, not because I have some slides, but the other important remark on which instead I want to focus is that, okay, let's take seriously the dark matter interpretation of the Pamela attic, maybe also Fermi results later, and let's see what can be said about that from gamma ray experiments, from gamma ray observations and gamma ray and radio wave observations. Okay? So, what that means is that I'm going to this set of the indirect detection domain, gamma rays. Again, in the basic picture, so which gamma rays I'm going to consider? I'm going to consider gamma rays from dark matter annihilation at the galactic center, which is exactly the same thing as the charged particles I have considered so far. So dark matter annihilates there, and integrating on the cone that looks at the galactic center, you expect to see fluxes of gamma rays that are typically sub-TeV or so, because that's the mass of the particle that you are trying to detect. Okay, so first thing. Second thing, you can focus on dwarf galaxies such as Sagittarius dwarf and so on, and trying to see the signature of the gamma rays from those sources, okay, that are probably less contaminated by the background of our own galaxy. Third thing, you can try to detect radio waves from the synchrotron radiation of the E plus E minus in the galactic center. Okay, so that is dark matter annihilates in the galactic center, produces energetic E plus and E minuses that are immersed in the strong magnetic field of the center of the galaxy, and so they emit synchrotron radiation that falls in the radio wave wavelength, and so you should see that. In order to compute that, what you have to do is to compute the population of electrons and positrons that are produced by dark matter annihilation there, and that you can do once you have a given model of mass, primary channel, and annihilation cross-section. And also you have to assume something on the configuration of the galactic magnetic field at the center of the galaxy. And this is what we assumed, for instance, different possibilities, equipartition magnetic field or constant magnetic field in the very inner part of the galaxy below 1 parsec or so. Fourth and last thing, you can look for gamma rays from inverse Compton scattering of the energetic pluses and the minus in the galactic halo. Okay, so the idea here is that the dark matter annihilates, produces energetic plus and the minuses. Those scatter on the ambient light and get up at the ambient light, gets up scattered to gamma ray waves, gamma rays energies, and you collect them. Okay, so the ambient light consists of the CMB, which is everywhere, the infrared light rescattered from the galactic, rescattered from the, you're not supposed to look, this is a, I see what happened. So the ambient light consists of several different things, the CMB, the infrared light from the galaxy, from the stars in the galaxy, reprocessed by scattering over dust, and finally, I will never get there, and finally starlight from the optical, in the optical wavelength from stars themselves. Okay, so here we are. And I'm going to show that in a second. Okay, so, but before showing the results, I have to tell you what, okay, one more thing. So this, the inverse Compton computation is interesting because it can allow you to probe regions that are outside from the galactic center. Okay, so the same point that Luca was mentioning. You're not forced to go where the galactic center, the galactic magnetic field is larger, or even where the density is larger. You can stay outside of that, and so you have a much less contamination and much less dependence on the uncertain dark matter profile, as I will show later. Okay, so let's go and compare with the data in this sector, so gamma rays. First, let's consider the gamma rays from the galactic center. So here is a picture of the galactic center from given by S that has detected gamma rays, the emission of gamma rays from the galactic center, which is this small angular region here of about 0.1 degrees, and also from the galactic ridge, which is a slightly larger region around here of about 0.8 degrees. So from the galactic center, what they have seen are these data points here. Okay, so that are fitted very well by a power law. And so what we do is to assume that this is astrophysics, because it's so clearly a power law, and instead constrain the possible dark matter flux, which is represented here, by requiring that it cannot exceed by more than 3 sigma at any given data point the observation, the Hess observations. Okay, that's the most conservative thing that you can do. So in this case, you take a dark matter with a mass of 10 TeV that goes into the plus W minus with this annihilation cross section. This is the flux that you would get. It's okay because you are not exceeding any one of these data points. Okay. A more aggressive thing that one can do is instead to sum it to an assumed astrophysical background, which is a power law, and then get something which is this curve here. This would be excluded because it's exceeding the data points by some sigmas. But we are not doing that. We are doing the most conservative thing of considering signals only. In the galactic ridge, same thing. These are the points that have been proposed, that have been published by Hess. And as you see, this candidate instead gives you this flux. And so it's excluded by these two data points. Okay. From satellite galaxies, simply the constraint is that Hess has looked into Sagittarius dwarf, has seen no emission in gamma rays, and so you can get an upper bound on the possible annihilation cross section there. In terms of radio waves, the idea is the same. There are compilations of data at different wavelengths of the radio wave to infrared emission from the galactic center, and in particular, these are computations of different dark matter models by Ullio and Regis. And the most constraining point, so any dark matter computation has to stay below the data points. And the most constraining ones are these ones from 78 at 408 megahertz, and this one from the VLT telescope in the infrared wavelength. So the argument is always the same. You want to stay down below, and so you put constraints on the annihilation cross section. In terms of inverse Compton scattering, what we did is to consider both the EGRET and the preliminary Fermi data that were presented half an hour ago. The egress data are from several different windows, but in particular from this 10 to 60 degree region that contains the galactic center. And here are the data points here. So this is a particular model of dark matter that gives you this signal that must not exceed any one of these points. These are the three components I mentioned before, on starlight, on infrared light, and on CMB. For the Fermi data points, here are the old egret points, here are the new Fermi points that exclude the egret excess, and again, the game is always the same. Here is the signal from dark matter that has not to exceed. Okay, so what are the results? These are the constraints. For a given candidate, goes to the plus and minus, and assuming an NFW profile, the region individuated by Pamela and Pamela plus Attic is excluded by several different things. Okay, so you should see much more gamma rays from the galactic center that you don't see, from the galactic region that you don't see, more radio waves that you don't see, and so you exclude this part here. That is true also if you look at other annihilation channels, E plus E minus, mu plus E minus, tau plus tau minus, L plus B minus, and so on. Generically, there is a conflict between gamma rays and the regions identified in terms of dark matter interpretation by Pamela and Pamela plus Attic. Now, if instead you change the dark matter profile, so from MFW you move to something which is cored, such as the isothermal profile, instead you reallow a lot of dispersions, okay? And that's easier to understand because you're looking at the galactic center now, and if you take a much shallower profile there, then you expect to see less gamma rays, and so these regions are reopened here. So the bottom line is that a not too steep profile is needed in order not to run into conflict with this kind of gamma rays from the galactic center. Yes, but one could always say, yes, but I mean, there could be different boost factors here around the Earth than there at the galactic center, and those affect different particles, positrons from Pamela and the gamma rays for the constraints that I'm considering here. Or, after all, we don't know anything about the dark matter profile below 100 parsecs, so there could be something such as a Navarro-Franke-White, but with a central void or something like that, that could allow you to walk around this kind of constraints. Okay, so that's why one has also to worry about the inverse quantum constraints that come from regions outside the galactic center or large enough that the detail of the galactic center is not very important. And so this is the result that we get. These are the regions identified by Pamela and Pamela plus Attic. For this particular candidate with an Enastro dark matter profile, what you see is again that most of the region is in trouble with this kind of constraints. Okay? Here are the windows that we are considering, and the most constraining one is this one from egret 10 to 60 degrees that cuts all the region here. And in this case, if you change the dark matter profile and you move to an isothermal profile, not much changes. Yes, a factor of two or something like that, but still the bounds remain and don't evaporate as they did before. Okay, so I think I'll go to the conclusions directly. And the conclusions are quite generic and are these ones. Okay, indirect dark matter searches are powerful and promising, blah, blah, blah. The recent Pamela results are most probably a breakthrough, and the important thing is that an excess is seen in positrons, but nothing in antiprotons. If you try to fit that in terms of dark matter annihilations, what you discover is that dark matter must annihilate only into leptons or annihilate into other channels, but with a mass larger than 10 TeV. And in any case, you need a huge flux. So that's not really your garden variety vanilla dark matter, and that's why so many theories have been proposed recently. Now, if you add the balloon data such as Attic and PPP bets, you must annihilate again into leptons only, and the mass is very well pinpointed by the Attic peak, if it's there. If you add gamma ray and synchrotron constraints and inverse Compton constraints, then you start running into trouble, because what you need is a not too steep dark matter profile, or maybe in the case of inverse Compton scattering, not even that is sufficient in order to take you out of the trouble. So all of this will be, of course, settled by future data, upcoming or even coming right now data by Pamela, Fermi, and AMS, and so on. Or maybe we'll just discover that it's just astrophysics. Okay. So the topics that I have not touched are these ones. What are the implications of the E plus and E minus data? If there are bounds from neutrinos on the galaxy center as well? If the dark matter models are not the simple ones that are self-annihilating dark matter that I have considered, but if there is a richer dark sector, such as the one with new light vectors, cascade annihilations, and so on, or if dark matter decays itself, and so on and so forth. So we are fortunate enough to have one of these two guys that are the experts here in order to talk about that later. Thank you.
So when you have a very heavy dark matter, like 10 GeV, right, and you assume a very large enhancement of the annihilation cross-sections to match whatever formula, and then you are at the mercy of some particle physics mechanism. It's mostly sometimes called Sommerfeld, but for this huge enhancement, you usually need to be close to a resonance or so of some kind, or some bound state and so on. And then you can imagine the higher the factor you need, the more sensitive you become to the details of the velocity distribution of your waves, right? So if you go to the center, the enhancement factor can be orders of magnitude different.
Okay, so that's true in general, but for instance, in the case of the Sommerfeld effect, the galactic velocity, I mean, for typical galactic velocities, such as the order of 10 to the minus 3 or so, it's already saturated. Okay, so if it's different from the in the early universe and nowadays in the galaxy.
But I understand what I'm saying that.
I guess yes, the statement.
You can be very close to the usually when Sommerfeld factor is just alpha over E, so it's not a huge enhancement. So if you want to have a huge enhancement, you need to be close to a bound state resonance.
Okay.
And. How close you are is set by what your velocity is, and then you can become very sensitive to distribution of velocities of dark matter, which is, I guess, another systematic uncertainty that you have to include.
Yeah.
The radio the Davies bound, how localized the in terms of how close the magnetic sensor is.
Yes, it's 4 seconds.
1 parsec.
1 parsec.
So it's very sensitive to the halo
propagation. It's very sensitive to the halo propagation, for sure. I think it's 4 seconds, which translates to 1 parsec. 4.3 seconds.
Your background calculation. What is exactly in your positron background? Because I noticed that the antiproton seems to be pretty consistent with the data, but the positron background seems to be kind of undershooting it a bit.
Yes, no, not sure. Of course.
So where is it coming from is number one question, and the number two question is what's the impact if you are to change that?
No, we changed that indeed. So in this sense, I show you just the one, this one, I think. So the computation, the shape of the vacuum that we assume comes from these papers here, okay? So old papers, the standard, but old papers of experimental sound and so on. And what we did is to take, and these are the fitting formula that you get in this paper, I think. And it's this line here, okay? What we did is to, in order to do the fits that I talked about, is to leave the slope free by plus or minus 0.05, okay? So we allow it to do like this. Multiplying by an E plus E times E power P in front, okay? And also the normalization is left free within the uncertainty that we get from our data analysis and so on. Roughly a factor of 2, okay? So that's what you assume for the background. That's an assumption, of course. Now, there is the possibility that the background is the wrong path here. And for instance, if you assume a different flux of electrons, this is what you get for the background of the positron fraction, something that goes like this and not really as the one that I'm using here. Okay, so this is something that Pierre can tell you much better about. Did I answer? Yeah.
Sorry. Yes, speaking of just astrophysics, when you look at beyond just the scale of galactic center, these inverse Compton calculations, I wonder what sort of positron electron energies are involved. Perhaps they are a little bit lower than this, because, for instance, on scales of megaparsecs like clusters, it has been known for over a decade now. There is the phenomenon of the soft X-ray and the hard X-ray excesses that could be interpreted as the existence of indicative of an existence of an underlying power law. But I suspect if the positron starts at 10 GeV, that would be too high an energy, let alone the cross section and the density.
No, but what I'm doing is to compute only the dark matter produced inverse Compton flux. Okay, so I'm taking a dark matter, I'm making it annihilate, and it produces the fluxes of electrons and positrons,
yes,
of which I know the spectrum and the typical energy very well, because they're determined by the dark matter itself. Okay.
Yes, but you also mentioned constraints on scales outside the galactic center. That's what I...
Yeah, but from dark matter on. I mean, what I'm doing is to compute... I'm not sure I'm getting your point. So what I'm doing is to compute the flux of inverse quantum gamma rays from dark matter ventilation and compare with the data, requiring that the flux from dark matter does not exceed what is possibly background of some sort.
Yes, that's precisely the point I'm talking about, and that is that... depending on this, the spectrum of these excess electrons, if they become a little bit lower than 10 GeV, there are also constraints on megaparsec scales from these excesses of in the X-ray range,
okay,
rather than in the gamma ray range.
Okay, now, this is always galactic side, galactic scale anyway. So I'll ask for you.